Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. Pfizer says it plans to ask the Food and Drug Administration for authorization to provide a booster dose of its vaccine. The company says getting a third shot within a year of the first two would increase immunity and protect against some of the most worrisome variants. But in an unusual move, the CDC and the FDA immediately released a statement saying that fully vaccinated Americans still don't need a booster. So with a vaccine maker recommending a booster shot and the government saying not so fast, let's bring in Dr. Peter Hotez. He's co-director of the Center for Vaccine Development at Texas Children's Hospital, and he joins us today by Skype. Doctor, welcome back.
Thanks so much.
So Pfizer is saying that a booster can increase protective antibodies by 5 to 10 times and that the first two doses start to lose effect after about 6 months. But there have also been other studies that we've reported on that show long-lasting immunity from these vaccines. So help us make sense of all this and how we should interpret it.
Yeah, and the truth is it's all true. The problem is this is why we don't like doing science by press release, because remember when multinational companies send out press releases, they're not writing it for you or for me. They're writing it for their shareholders, and the goal is to jack up stock prices. And that press release was written, like all their other press releases, were written in a very confusing way. And then requires people like myself to do damage control for a few days after this. So it does get a little bit frustrating. So here's the thing. I've been saying for a number of months that ultimately a third dose of either the Pfizer-BioNTech or Moderna vaccine may be needed to really jack up the virus neutralizing antibodies and other T and B cell responses in order to make us more resilient against all the variants that are emerging globally, in part because we're doing such a terrible job in vaccinating Africa and Latin America and Southeast Asia, which is a whole nother issue that we have to address. But the point is, it's not surprising to hear that we may need a third immunization to give us long-lasting and more durable protection. The problem is, I don't know that we necessarily need to do this because of the Delta variant, because the two doses seem to be giving pretty robust protection. So they quote the 64% protection coming out of Israel. Yes, but in Britain, it's been around 88%, Scotland, close to 80%, Canada, 87%. So there's still a lot of studies to look through. So that's a point. And the next is, I'm a little surprised that they would use an emergency use authorization to pursue a boost. I've never seen anything quite like that. I understand the time pressures and the urgencies for doing emergency use authorization initially, but now we should be moving to full approval, and then the mechanisms for going through the need for a boost is carefully orchestrated through CDC and FDA, and I think we should be following those processes. So it's, yes, I do think we ultimately will need a third immunization. I don't know that we need to do it now, and I don't know that we need to do it against the Delta variant, if that makes any sense.
All right. I think it does. So we may need a booster, but it's not clear whether we need it right now. On the other hand, it's possible that Pfizer is right, that the time is of the essence here, because for many first responders, you know, they got vaccinated back in December or January, and it's now July.
Yeah, and I did as well. But you know, they don't really present evidence that again, this is why we don't like doing this by press release, that immunity truly is waning, even if virus neutralizing antibodies are declining. You know, work by people like Akiko Iwasaki at Yale and others have shown that we've got memory B cells and memory T cells. There are a lot of other elements that go into protective immunity to at least over the long term in terms of durability of protection. So I'm not convinced that immunity really has waned. And this is something that we're going to – and part of the problem also is the CDC needs to do a somewhat better job at following up on breakthrough infections to really see how common this phenomenon is.
Right. So tell me, how will we know? When will we know whether a booster is necessary?
Well, I think we'll know over, you know, we're going to get a much better sense now in the next few weeks, because the Delta variant is sweeping through the country, and tragically, so many young adults and middle-aged adults have been defiant of vaccines, we know they're going to get very sick. And so far what we've seen is that more than 99%, maybe 99.5% of those hospitalized have been or tragically lost their lives have been unvaccinated individuals. So I think that we're already seeing that so far the vaccine looks like it's holding up pretty well against Delta.
Dr. Peter Hotez, co-director of the Center for Vaccine Development at Texas Children's Hospital, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
In Haiti, the country's chief of police is saying dozens of foreigners came into the country and killed its president. President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated early Wednesday in his private residence, and Haitian authorities have identified 28 attackers. Many of them are now in custody. Two of them are U.S. nationals of Haitian descent. For more, we're joined by Widlore Merincourt, editor-in-chief of the Haitian news outlet Aibo Post. Widlore, what can you tell us about the attackers the chief is identifying?
According to the authorities, 28 persons participated actively in the attacks. 26 of them were Colombians. Among these 26 Colombians, 15 was captured. They had also two Haitian Americans, and these two Haitian Americans are also captured. So police officers are still investigating, trying to better know what happened. One of the U.S. Citizens had a discussion with local media here in Haiti. He said that he found out about the operation on the internet, and he was in the country for one of them was in the country for 1 month, and the other was there for several months. This is what we know so far.
You know, meanwhile, there's the aftermath to deal with, and the interim Prime Minister Claude Joseph has declared a 2-week state of siege following the assassination. It's something akin to martial law. So, Widlore, I'm curious, you're in Port-au-Prince, the capital. Tell us what it's like there.
Okay, so right after the assassination, Claude Joseph, who is the Prime Minister, effectively declared the state of siege. But in a press conference recently, he said that everything should be back to normal. So the airport, which was closed, is supposed to open. And if you go to the street today, you can see, you can feel that things are slowly getting back to normal. Some businesses are open. Of course, some big businesses are still closed because people are trying to be cautious. It's a very volatile situation. But you can see in the street, you see more cars, you see more folks going out to do their own activities. So I think people are still tense. People are still trying to understand effectively what happened. We know this was an attack. We know how many people participated, but we still don't know who is behind it and what is the motives of the persons who carried it out.
Yeah, there's a lot of questions still to be answered about the assassination itself. And then there's a lot of questions about what comes next. There's really a lot of political turmoil. There was supposed to be elections again in a few months. There's a dispute about who the proper prime minister is. Claude Joseph is the interim right now. But just days before his death, President Moïse had appointed a successor, Ariel Henry, who was due to take office later. He is also making a claim to the office. And meanwhile, the country's top justice who might settle such matters died of COVID last month. So what is going on in terms of the political unrest?
Well, this is an interesting question because every democratic institution in this country was dismantled during the last three and a half years. You have only 10 elected officials where you're supposed to have, you know, hundreds. And you have, like you said, the head of the Supreme Court died from COVID. And you have a battle with regard to who have the authority to conduct the actions of the government. Like you stated, 2 days before the assassination of the president, he nominated a new prime minister. This prime minister, Mr. Ariel Henry, was in the process of building his own cabinet. So the previous prime minister resigned, Mr. Claude Joseph. Right now, you're seeing a very public clash between these two individuals. And you have the international community who is playing a war. But this war is being criticized by a large part of the opposition right here in Haiti. The U.S., for instance, recognized the authority of Mr. Claude Joseph. Some people are saying it's a good thing because he needs to fill the vacancy. But you have the United Nations who went out publicly, I think yesterday, to say that this prime minister should stay in power all the way until the next elections. But the thing is, a lot of political actors were saying before the killing of the president that you can't have an election, a free and fair election in this situation right now in Haiti, where a large swath of the country is being controlled by gangs.
Last thing, Widlor, we know that in addition to the president's assassination, the first lady was also injured. What else do we know about her condition right now?
According to the authorities, the first lady who was injured during the attack is in the U.S. So she's in a stable condition, and one of his child is with her.
So a bit of good news there in a really difficult circumstance. Widlor Merincourt is editor-in-chief of the Haitian news outlet Aibo Post. Thank you for joining us with the latest from Port-au-Prince.
Thank you.
President Biden met with civil rights groups yesterday to discuss voter suppression efforts following the demise of the Democrats' Voting Rights Act in the Senate last week. Meanwhile, Republican state lawmakers in Texas are renewing their effort to pass restrictive new voting laws in that state, part of a nationwide trend unfolding since the 2020 election. Democrats are accusing Republicans of undermining democracy with those new laws, but our next guest says the problem with American democracy goes even deeper. Osita Nwanevu is a writer for The New Republic. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Osita, you write that the broader project of saving American democracy is doomed for one fairly straightforward reason. America is not a democracy. At the federal level, we simply don't have a democratic system to save. Bold statement there. What do you mean exactly?
Right. So obviously, I think that the efforts to protect voting rights that we're seeing happen in Congress right now, the For the People Act, other alternative proposals that have been advanced, all of those are very important. But I don't think they could be reasonably characterized as legislation that's actually going to save a functional democracy. I think that we're in the place we're in this country, and to a large extent because our democratic institutions, our institutions that we believe are democratic, are actually pretty faulty. The reason why the For the People Act hasn't passed in the first place is that we have a Senate that grants a disproportionate amount of power to certain states. On top of that, we have a filibuster rule that is inherently undemocratic. So, you know, if it weren't for those things, we might have already developed a real solution to the rollback of voting rights we're seeing across the country.
Well, you say that the outcomes that we get from our federal institutions often don't align with public opinion. But I guess what I'm wondering is whether some of that is just the way our government has been structured from the beginning, because if we use the strictest definition of democracy, we might just put every issue on a ballot and let the will of the people decide. But that's not how we do things, right? We elect representatives to use their own judgment. And sometimes, for better and for worse, they make decisions that don't align with popular opinion.
Oh, I think that's absolutely the way the system has been designed from the very beginning. The argument that I'm making is that the design from the very beginning has been fundamentally flawed in ways that I think are only becoming more and more obvious now. And these are things that we've sort of rationalized to ourselves over the years. But they created very real disparities, and they've really frustrated, I think, policy progress on a lot of issues. Most Americans want to see something done on climate change in Washington. That hasn't happened. Gun control. Most Americans want to see a gun control bill of some kind pass. Hasn't happened. Raising taxes on the wealthy. Most Americans support that. Hasn't happened. I mean, you can go down the list. The real problem here is that we have a set of institutions in the United States, they're actually unusually undemocratic and unusually constraining of policies that the majority of the electorate really wants.
Yeah, you run through that list from climate change to gun control where there's a clear majority opinion and that's not the outcome that you get in the Congress because of Republican lawmakers. I'm wondering whether you think Democrats have also been guilty of enacting policies that don't match public sentiment. I'm thinking, for example, of the push for same-sex marriage. You know, most of the progress on that issue came from courts that were ruling against the will of the majority at the time. Same-sex marriage consistently lost on ballot measures in the aughts. Now, 70% of Americans support same-sex marriage today, according to Gallup, but most people opposed it when these legal battles were playing out. So are progressives picking and choosing when it's okay to go against what the majority wants?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it's absolutely true that at the time, same-sex marriage was much more of a controversial issue than it's become in the last couple of years. In fact, it's really extraordinary the extent to which public opinion has changed. But I think in any democratic system, you also have a set of rights that are sort of detached from the democratic process. We say that we can contest certain things over here, the implementation of certain policies, the size and scope of government, and those kinds of things. But we also say to ourselves, look, there's a Bill of Rights, there are amendments that have conferred more and more rights, basic rights to all classes of people in our society. And those things can't really be adjudicated by the democratic system. If you want to actually implement changes there, you often do have to appeal to existing jurisprudence, the Constitution. And I think that's absolutely fine. But I do think that in the areas where people really do expect dynamism and real policy change, you know, basic climate action. We can disagree on what that might look like, but most people think that something ought to be done. Same thing with gun control. Those kinds of issues where you expect Washington to be working on a regular basis, Washington hasn't been. And I think that's ultimately because, again, we have these institutions that are really sclerotic in ways that have become really, really disturbing to a lot of people.
Well, just to underscore the stakes, Osita, this week the president called the January 6th insurrection an existential crisis for democracy. Do you think he has a window of opportunity to do anything about it? Or do you think his hands are tied, regardless of whether he believes that this is a crisis moment for our democracy?
Well, I mean, I think that we could be hearing more from the president about the fundamental obstacle here, which is the legislative filibuster. Ultimately, that is the real obstacle here. There is a window, for sure. It's just a matter of whether the caucus can unite and tell itself that its agenda, not just the For the People Act, but the rest of its agenda, is worth sort of changing the institution of the Senate.
Well, I think you're hitting on a key point here, because there has long been this divide within the Democratic Party between more progressive folks who have railed against the party establishment, saying that they're beholden to corporate interests. But now you're also hearing from somebody like the president saying democracy is under attack. And Joe Biden, I think most liberals would agree, has long been part of the Democratic establishment. So there is some consensus building there.
Right.
What do you see unfolding?
Well, I'm not really sure. I mean, I think that there's what I'm seeing right now in on the Senate side is really kind of stasis. I don't think that there's a path to passing the For the People Act without dealing with the filibuster. Republicans just haven't been on board. So I think it's ultimately going to hinge on the filibuster question. And I think it's important for people to understand that this is not just a sort of progressives against the establishment issue. You're right. There's a real threat to voting rights happening here. But there isn't consensus on what needs to happen to actually pass something. So yeah, I can't really tell you what I expect to happen. I hope that we see a shift in the coming months, but I don't know that the rhetorical groundwork is being laid by the president or anyone else to sort of explain to the American people why this isn't passing and what ought to be done in order to pass it.
Osita Wenevu is a writer for The New Republic. Osita, thank you for talking democracy with us.
Thank you again for having me.
Millions of people in this country are behind on their rent payments because of the COVID crisis. And as a result, many landlords are struggling to pay their bills, too. Let's hear this report again from Chris Nichols of Cap Radio in Sacramento.
Before the pandemic, Ravi Kalan and her husband Raja Jagadeesan owned six rental properties, including some duplexes, in Sacramento and the Bay Area.
So we have a room here that you can look at.
They say their goal is to provide housing the community can afford. But after the economy shut down, four of their nine tenants stopped paying rent entirely.
September, we didn't get rent. October, we didn't. November, December, January, February,
March.
So that's $28,000 in just one county.
Without this revenue, the couple says they used personal savings to pay for repairs, property taxes, and their mortgages. But Jagadeesan says that approach just isn't sustainable.
We want to provide clean, safe housing for people, I mean, we need to at least make the numbers work out.
More than a year into the pandemic, the bills are continuing to pile up for small landlords who own nearly half the rental units in America and often provide housing that's affordable for middle and lower income renters. But as of this month, landlords still can't ask courts to remove tenants who aren't paying. That's because the federal government recently extended its eviction moratorium through the end of July. California continued its eviction ban through the end of September. But many renters can apply for 100% back rent, which will ease the situation somewhat.
What do we want? No eviction! When do we want it? Now!
At rallies like this one in Sacramento this spring, tenant advocates pushed for the bans to stay in place. They say they're needed because just a fraction of the billions of dollars in state and federal rent relief has gone out to those affected by COVID-19. But economists say the eviction ban puts a huge weight on small landlords, especially those whose rental income has dried up. Given the red-hot real estate market, they say some might just sell and get out of the rental business altogether.
Homes are selling very quickly, almost no matter what condition they're in.
That's Zillow senior economist Jeff Tucker.
And therefore, that is a tempting window of opportunity, especially for a small-time landlord, to cash out and sell that home.
Those sales are happening, but not to other mom-and-pop owners, says Russell Lowry, who heads the California Rental Housing Association, which represents landlords.
We believe we're shifting the landlord mix from smaller to corporate.
That shift could mean fewer entry-level rental options. Renter advocates like Shanti Singh of Tenants Together say they also want to avoid more corporate ownership, which can be less forgiving to renters.
We definitely don't want to see a further consolidation of property in the hands of corporate landlords. We have been fighting that.
Back in Sacramento, small landlord Raja Jagadeesan says he and his wife ended up selling half their properties. He says they couldn't make the numbers work.
We're not getting any rent from property X, but we are bleeding money every month. And so then we have to make those hard decisions. Like, I think we have to sell. And that happened not once, not twice, but three times.
He says one went to a young couple who planned to live at the home, taking it off the rental market. Another went to an investor who Jagadeesan says will likely slap some paint on it and then raise the rent. For NPR News, I'm Chris Nichols in Sacramento.
Capitalism touches every part of our lives.
Capitalism is a giant force that I don't understand.
I feel that it's a very safe system.
I'm constantly in fear of losing my job.
It is our biggest success and our biggest failure.
On this special series from Throughline, Capitalism.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
President Biden is trying to make it easier for people to leave their jobs for a better opportunity. The plan is to crack down on non-compete agreements as part of a larger executive order that President Biden is signing today. These non-compete agreements make it tougher for workers to switch to a rival company, and according to the White House, tens of millions of American workers have signed them. Mike Regan is senior editor for Bloomberg News. Mike, good to speak with you.
You too, Peter.
And tell me, what does a worker typically agree to when they do sign one of these agreements?
So it's basically an agreement that you sign that says when I leave this company, I won't go work for a competing company, at least for a certain amount of time that's set out in the agreement. And it's something people either sign off on when they take a job or else when they get laid off, Peter. It's an agreement that they must sign in order to receive a severance package when they are laid off.
All right. Well, the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said this week that about half of private sector businesses require at least some of their employees to sign these agreements. When, you know, that's kind of surprising because we would assume that they're tied to really high profile jobs. But in fact, all sorts of industries and jobs require them.
Well, yeah, that's true. They are very prevalent in, say, financial services industry, where a firm doesn't want a banker or trader to leave and take their clients or their knowledge of a company's strategy with them. pretty common in the technology industry as well as a way to protect trade secrets. So interestingly, in California, where a lot of big tech firms are based, that state actually doesn't allow them to be enforced. But you're right. I think the White House is really trying to focus on a wide variety of industries that make lower paid hourly wage earner jobs, make those people sign off on these and really kind of handcuffs them when it's time to look for a new job.
Well, this is really relevant because we've been reporting a lot lately on how so many people are looking for new jobs as we emerge from this pandemic. But do we know how these kinds of agreements impact workers and their lives when they're looking for new work?
Yeah, there was a very in-depth report a couple years ago from the Economic Policy Institute, and they contended that these really do hurt wage growth, since changing jobs is often a way for a worker to get a bump in pay. And one really interesting point that they made in that report is that so many employees don't even realize they agreed to one, since these agreements can be tucked away in some employee handbook or some other thick stack of papers that a worker gets when they are hired. And, you know, obviously, Peter, a lot of us don't read all those papers when we're hired.
Right. So this is just one part of a much bigger order. The Biden administration also wants to target what it's calling unnecessary occupational licensing requirements. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so these are the one example that Biden has actually mentioned in the past specifically is a hairstylist. You know, it takes many hours of training to get that license to be a hairstylist. But the problem is they vary from state to state. So if you move to a different state, you have to go through the whole study process and licensing process again. And that can really be damaging to someone's career, say if their spouse moves and they're following them and all of a sudden they're in a new state and they have to go through that whole process again. So that's something he wants to eliminate.
All right. Mike Regan is senior editor for Bloomberg News. Thanks very much for joining us. Mike, have a really good weekend.
You too, Peter. Thank you.
In Florida this week, Governor Ron DeSantis would not commit to a statewide review of older condo buildings, such as the Champlain Tower South, which collapsed 2 weeks ago. Champlain Tower South has sadly become a symbol of the worst in condominiums, which are often owned and managed by tenants with little oversight. And what happened in Surfside has made a lot of condo owners and prospective buyers nervous. Let's talk Condo 101 with Evan McKenzie. He's a professor of condominium and homeowner association law at the University of Illinois at Chicago Law School. Evan, welcome to Here and Now.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We're glad to have you, and I'm wondering if you were surprised to learn that owners at the Champlain Tower South building were being asked to pay special assessments of hundreds of thousands of dollars to address an estimated $15 million worth of needed repairs. And that despite that, the governor did not want to commit to reviewing other older condo buildings.
Yeah, I have to say that neither of those things really surprises me, because special assessments, and often, you know, five-figure and even six-figure special assessments in older condo buildings are becoming increasingly common. It's terrible, but it's happening a lot in this country. And the other thing that unfortunately does not surprise me is that we have state government officials who don't want to accept any responsibility for making the situation better. That has happened in a number of states, unfortunately.
Well, let's drill down on that, because you're calling, as I understand it, for more oversight of condo boards, which would require presumably more government involvement. So first of all, maybe you can explain how little oversight there actually is, and then what are the measures that you are advocating?
Yes. Well, you know, about 20 to 25% of the nation's population is living in either condominiums or homeowners associations, private communities, in other words. Nonetheless, almost all the states have virtually no oversight in place of the association's finances. They are all run by untrained, unsupported, often unqualified volunteer directors who are just simply elected. The only qualification is that you're an owner. And they have enormous responsibilities, but they don't really have any oversight in place. Most of the states don't even know how many condominium developments they have in the state. They don't know how many people are in them, and they know virtually nothing about the finances of those associations or the condition of the buildings. I think that's really a shocking lapse in public oversight, and it could be easily fixed.
I suppose the thinking, though, is that condo owners who are managing these associations would be heavily invested in what's best for their buildings. This is their investment, maybe their home after all, but there may also be sort of absentee landlords. Maybe they own a unit in the condo building, but they don't actually live there. Is there a difference in management between those things when you have owner-occupied condo owners who are managing the buildings versus people who are actually not there?
Yes, that's a good point. There certainly is a difference. For some people, it's just an investment property, and they may not really want to put money into it. And other people living there may, you know, want to maintain the building to a higher standard. Now, that's certainly one difference. But another difference is simply that there's what the economists call a collective action problem, in the sense that each individual owner has an incentive to keep their own payments as low as possible and to contribute as little as possible to the building. But collectively, that hurts all of them when there's a big repair that needs to be done and they haven't set aside the money in advance.
We asked you here for your professional and legal expertise, Evan, but I have to ask a personal question, which is, would you yourself ever buy a condominium?
I would only under certain conditions, very limited. I would have to know that they had done what we call a reserve study. A reserve study is where that you have a building professional go out and evaluate the entire building, top to bottom, and tell you what you need, when you're going to need it, how many years down the road, and how much you should be setting aside for those repairs, so that the assessment levels are set in a realistic way, so you won't be surprised by the costs when they arise. So I'd want to know that there was a current reserve study done at least within the last 3 years, and that those recommendations were followed, because the boards and the association control their own assessment levels. And they often just keep them too low for their own reasons. But if I were going to move into one, I'd want to insist on knowing all the details about the financials before I would ever buy.
But you know what to look for. You're an expert. This is one of your specialties in the law. For the layman who may be thinking about buying a condo, what would be the first thing you would advise?
I would say, if you have an attorney involved in this, then even before you get involved in a contract, normally you're entitled to disclosure of financials from the association after you're under contract. But if I were shopping, I would say to a potential seller, I would say, I need to see the financials before I put an offer down. I need to see your latest reserve study. I need this information up front before I put down an offer. That is what I would do. And often, if you really insist on it, you can make that happen.
Is that harder now, though, Evan? I wonder, because the real estate market is so hard. We're seeing some folks waiving things that would typically be part of basic due diligence, the inspections, because they're in a bidding war for a unit.
Yes, that is an excellent point. And nonetheless, the way I look at it, the risks of buying into a private community, and especially a condo, and especially an older condo building, are so great that I would simply forego the opportunity if I couldn't find out where things stood financially with the association. I simply would not do it, because a special assessment can hit you down the road a few years that would wipe out any equity gain you might have had from buying, in a hot market.
It's worth pointing out, too, that there's a huge difference in scale here, a huge range. The tower that collapsed in Florida was, just as the name suggests, a large tower, many units. There are also condo associations that are quite small, 2, 3, 4 units. We've heard real estate people say it's sort of like going into business with people you don't know. What do you think about that?
Yes. And it is a thing that many people don't think about when they're shopping for a condo, because they think of it as if it were a single family home, when it's actually shared ownership arrangement.
So you're advising that folks really do their diligence when it comes to the building itself, the association's finances. Is it also worth knowing what the state or even county level rules for condo building inspections are? Because in Florida, for example, only Miami-Dade and Broward counties require that these older high-rises go through a re-inspection. There's actually no statewide requirement to inspect beneath any surface.
Right. Not only that, in the whole state of Florida, which is more condos than almost any other state, they don't even have a requirement that the associations do periodic reserve studies. So in other words, these boards aren't even required to fully inform themselves through a professional as to what their needs are. So So how can they intelligently establish reserve funds and know what's coming down the road, know what to prepare for and what to maintain if they aren't even required to bring in a professional? So, yeah, I think you should know what your state or city mandates. And I think people will be very surprised when they find out how little oversight there is in almost every single state in the country.
Let me ask you one other sort of really specific question, but it may come up a lot if people are taking just sort of like a visual glance at their unit and they see an apparent crack that's at least an eighth of an inch wide. That's not all that big, but some engineers say that's actually the size when cracks are a concern. So what do you do if you see one of those? And especially what do you do if the condo association is dragging its feet about getting it repaired? What options do you have?
Yeah, well, that is a very difficult situation. In some situations, people have been known in condo buildings, if they see cracks in structural members, you know, the beams of the parking garage and the pillars that hold the building up and this sort of thing, they have been known, and water leaking and that sort of thing, serious problems. They've been known, you know, first you have to contact your board. If they don't act, then you can contact building officials yourself. You can try to bring in the building officials. Municipalities tend to defer to the condo board because they view it as a responsibility that has now been assumed by the volunteer condo board. And it's not really a public responsibility. It is a public responsibility, but too often they abdicate. But you do have to go to public authorities at times. It has to be done. It can be difficult. But if you can't get any recourse from the board, you may have to do something like that.
Not to scare people entirely away from condos, as you said yourself, you would consider buying one under the right circumstances, but a good reminder to make sure you do your diligence before you make an investment like this. Evan McKenzie is a professor of condominium and homeowner association law at the University of Illinois at Chicago Law School. Evan, thank you.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Fewer families are choosing burials for deceased loved ones, opting instead for cremation, which is leaving more cemeteries vacant. As Connecticut Public Radio's Patrick Scahill reports, the trend is helping forge a new link between the Catholic Church and the solar industry.
Picture a solar field, and what do you see? Probably a large open space, flat and dry, without too many trees and with lots of sunlight. Now think about a cemetery. Swap out those solar panels for gravestones, and the location suddenly have something in common. So why not combine the two?
We're not going to be putting solar panels over existing gravestones. That's not something that's going to be happening.
Will Herschel is CEO of Verigy, a Hartford-based solar developer, and he says the industry needs a readjustment.
There's a lot of rooftops that are available, and there's a lot of rooftops that aren't available. And the amount of solar and renewable energy that we have to put out there is so significant that you need to kind of take a look at all comers and all different types and solutions.
So Herschel and his team started looking at unused cemetery plots. Today, we're standing at one in Torrington, a solar array his company just built on land owned by the Catholic Cemeteries Association of the Archdiocese of Hartford. About 7,000 solar panels are sitting on a dozen acres. And no, none of the panels are over tombstones. In fact, Brian Fitzgerald, Verigy's director of development, says the array and the cemetery are totally separate.
You have a good bit of forest in between the cemetery and the solar farm, so you cannot see the solar farm from the cemetery, you can't see the cemetery from the solar farm.
Solar energy has amped up production in recent years as costs have dropped and the state has eyed aggressive renewable energy targets. Meanwhile, the funeral industry is also undergoing a major shift. Fewer families are burying their loved ones. David McDonald is president of the Connecticut Funeral Directors Association.
Cremation has steadily increased over the years, and it seems like it will continue to increase.
McDonald says 2020 was an awful year for funeral directors. Statistics from the State Office of the Chief Medical Examiner show the impact of COVID meant thousands of additional cremations compared to the prior year. But the shift from fewer burials to more cremations dates back long before the pandemic. State data show a steady rise in cremations for reported deaths dating back to the 1990s. In the 1960s, the Catholic Church said cremation was an acceptable funeral rite, And in 2016, the church issued new guidelines acknowledging cremation's rise, while noting burial was still preferred by the church. McDonald says that trend toward cremation means owners of land earmarked for burials need to get creative.
If they thought years ago there's this many people in the world, we're going to be doing this many burials, and it's declined, well, they still need money to pay the employees to mow their lawn and keep the place up to par.
So cemeteries have created new fees to generate income. Or in the case of the Catholic Cemeteries Association of the Archdiocese of Hartford, they've turned to developers like Verogy. John Pannone, executive director of the CCA, wouldn't say how much money his group was poised to bring in over the course of its 20-year solar lease in Torrington. But he says the CCA did look hard at burials versus cremations and asked a simple question. Would bodies need to go into that unused cemetery space in the next two decades?
And the answer was no. The answer also is that we knew in 20 years if we do need the land back, we can get it back. This is just a lease. So I think it allows us flexibility to create another source of revenue.
While a 20-year lease might seem daunting for the average person, back at the Torrington Array, Verogy's Will Herschel says cemetery owners think and plan generationally.
That's why they're interested in the concept of renewable energy, especially solar, because unlike other forms or other uses of property, this is something that's not permanent, right?
And may, two decades from now, make room for other uses like a farm, or if needed, a final resting place for the dead. For Here and Now, I'm Patrick Scahill.
And now, the moment of truth from the Scripps National Spelling Bee competition last night at Walt Disney World, Florida.
Maria. Does this word contain, like, the English name Mary, which could be the name of a comedian, or just the English name in general?
I don't see that here.
Bill Murray made the spelling bee.
As the judges told 14-year-old Zaila Avant-Garde, Maria does not refer to the comedian Bill Murray. But Zaila had one more question for the judges.
Wait, what is the language origin?
It's formed in Latin from a Swedish name.
Maria. M-U-R-R-A-Y-A.
That is correct!
And with that, Zaila Avant-Garde from New Orleans became the first Black American student to win the competition.
And all her hard work paid off, studying the dictionary or maybe watching Caddyshack. The winning word, Maria, may be a genus of tropical trees, but there is something to that Bill Murray connection.
The reason I knew that word, Maria, was because of the movie Lost in Translation, which when I was a little kid, I used to listen to the soundtrack, and so that's how that word stuck in my head, because it spelled like Bill Murray's name.
And that is a well-rounded kid who just made history. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter, of Irish origin, O, apostrophe, capital D, O-W-D.
And I'm Callum Borchers. This is H-E-A-R-A-N-D-N-O-W.
Oh, Callum.
Peter, you win again, but your word was easier.